at nytedu.com.
Welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. You were just listening to something that happened many years ago in Tunisia. The people of Tunis went out to the streets to claim and ask for their freedom and to kick the president, Ben Ali, out of the country. So listen to this music. This is what we're going to be talking about today. The Tunisian Revolution, BDS in Congress, and Pompeo's speech in Cairo, and open the phone lines. But before we begin, listen to Amal, who is from Tunisia and performs this amazing song. It's called Kelmeti Hurra, My Word is Free, and she performed this live at the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize concert. Listen to this. This is True Talk on WMNF.org.
أنا في حلق الظالم شوكا
And welcome back to True Talk. This is the song by Amal Mathlouthi, and she performed it at the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize. The words are amazing. Maybe we can talk about it, but she is singing, she's Tunisian, and singing about freedom of speech and the ability to express yourself. So I'm very pleased to say that Monji Dawoodi is on the phone with me. He is living at the moment in Washington, D.C., I think. But Monji is originally Tunisian. I think he was born in Tunisia, came to this country when he was 19 years old to study electrical engineering. And I'm not sure how he ended up working with institutions like CSID, the Study of Islam and Democracy, and working extensively in civil society. And I think at the moment he might be working with my co-host. Good morning, Monji.
Good morning, Samar.
Did I mention your background correctly? You were born in Tunisia?
Excellent. Yes, I was born in Tunisia, raised and graduated high school from Tunisia, and came to this country a while ago.
So when you were born in Tunisia, you had, and since you left, there was only one president in your lifetime in Tunisia.
That's correct. Back then, it was the President Bourguiba. He was president right after the French left. He was president all the way until 1987, and I came to the States in 1985, a couple years before that. And yes, during my lifetime, I've known Bourguiba as the president of Tunisia.
You know, I like to mention these things to our audience and listeners because, you know, they think sometimes a president staying for 8 years is a long time. But imagine all your young life, you're one president. And then maybe if your family or somebody was born around the late 80s, they also ended up with a president that stayed more than, 25 years, Ben Ali?
Exactly. So Ben Ali came into power in 1987 after he basically ousted what we call the bloodless coup. Mm-hmm. He presented a certificate from doctors saying that Bourguiba can no longer perform his duties and functions of the presidency. Therefore, he was the prime minister at that time. He assumed power and all the way until the revolution that kicked off in December 2010. And it took about 3 weeks later, and in January 14, 2011, he fled the country and he's currently residing in Saudi Arabia.
Just in case people don't know, where is Tunisia and, you know, the location of it, could you tell us a little bit about Tunisia, like as a country, the location, anything unique about it?
Right. Tunisia is a beautiful country. It sits. It is probably the highest point in Africa. When you are looking directly at the African continent on a map, you look at the highest point, and you most likely will land on Tunisia. And it is a strip of land. It has coasts on the Mediterranean from the north and from the east side. It has a big border on the west with Algeria, and it has a border with the southwest. Southeast and the south with Libya. Obviously we have beautiful, beautiful beaches. It's a great destiny. It's a welcoming place. It's the population of Tunisia is around 11 to 12 million, I believe, at the current moment. Our young and Tunisians, they're known to be moderate. They're known to be educated, very open to the world. They sit on the junction between the west and the east. It's a beautiful country to visit. So if anybody is thinking about taking a vacation this summer, I would definitely suggest take a look at Tunisia.
One of the unique things about Tunisia was very liberal, open-minded. And I think actually whether Habib Bourguiba or Ben Ali, the two former presidents, they were secular or at least very pro-women, or at least some people who are a little bit more Islamist and conservative would find them extremely open-minded when it comes to issues related to women, for instance. Is that true?
Right, and I think it's more so of Bourguiba than Ben Ali. I mean, Bourguiba was is known to be very well educated. He studied obviously in some of the schools in Tunisia at first under the occupation of the French, and then he went finished his studies in France. Just like many of the young Tunisians of his generation, and so that openness throughout history, even before then, of Tunisia to many civilizations, many different people, made us a society that is very moderate, very tolerant, very accepting to the others. And it's not a surprise that Tunisia is, whether it's under Bourguiba or later on, Ben Ali kind of tried to use that to his advantage. He wasn't a man of vision. He was not a man of intellect. He was basically a military police officer. That trend continued because of the Tunisian society and the Tunisian people. And so even now, after the revolution and after the Arab Spring, we see Tunisia lead in so many indicators, even surpass many of the Western countries in terms of women participation, in terms of some of the more forward-leaning laws that were passed against discrimination, racism, against domestic violence, all these, and even the participation of women and the young folks in politics today is very commendable. It's one of the benefits that the Arab Spring kind of built on the legacy that was left from the Bourguiba days.
On December 17th, 2010, something happened in a small town in Tunisia. And many people believe it was the catalyst for what came later, which later became known as the Arab Spring. Can you tell us what happened?
That's true. On December 17, a young man by the name of Mohamed Bouazizi basically lit himself on fire in front of the municipal building on the town of Sidi Bouzid. That was the spark of what is known now as the Arab Spring. The reason for that is because that kind of self-mutilation was foreign to the Tunisian society. It did happen before later on, but it wasn't something that people knew about, something that didn't catch the attention of the people. But this one resonated with the young folks. Bouazizi at the time was a street vendor that was frustrated. He was an educated person, but did not have a job. He had a family that was dependent on him. And out of frustration and lack of hope in the system that failed him, he took that drastic and tragic act that people in his town and then it spread all across Tunisia and then all, many other countries in the Arab world resonated with. That this is, we lived under a dictatorship. We lived under a regime that did not provide basic freedoms and rights to people. But at least at a certain point, people kind of made this trade and this, okay, fine, you're going to restrict my freedom, but at least I can find a job and I can provide for my family. But when things got really bad where you don't have freedom, you don't have your basic rights as a human being, yet you cannot even find a job to provide for your family, that was a bad combination. And after that, the advance in technology, Facebook, Twitter, social media, started to take root in Tunisian society. And so his story resonated with a lot of young folks who shared it on Facebook. And the authorities at that time tried and failed into kind of curtailing and containing his story. The media for days and weeks, the official media at the time, did not talk about this incident, did not talk about the protests that were spreading around the country, but people knew about them. The story got out mostly through social media.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and my name is Samar Jarrah, and my co-host Ahmed Bidir and myself have been doing this show for the past maybe 16, 17, 18 years, I'm not sure, but I'm talking to Monji Dawoodi, who lives in Washington, D.C. He is originally from Tunisia and came to this country when he was 19 years old and works deals with issues pertaining to the Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in America here. But he's talking to us about the Tunisian revolution that was, I think, Monji later been named the Jasmine Revolution. I'm not sure why. But so it started in a very small poor town and then started spreading from one town to the other. When did it come to the capital? And did other, for instance, what made the people later on start getting more courageous and not just asking for better jobs and better health services, but starting to say "dégagé," I think they were saying in French, "irhal, irhal," and then they started saying "ash'ab yurid isqat al-nizam," the people want to bring down the system or the regime.
The protests at first, as I said, were basically asking for reforms, asking for jobs, asking for basic services. But then it escalated because Bin Ali, who is known to be a strong, hand in military and security, he tries to address every issue through security forces, tried to escalate the oppressing the protesters and killed some of the protesters. I started going from rubber bullets to and tear gas and escalated to live ammunition and started, people started watching these videos, as I said, that are spreading on social media of people being shot and killed. And that seemed to inflame the Tunisians even more. And people started at that time started to demand that this regime must go and started chanting the famous word "dégage," which is in French means leave. And then it came to the capital a little later. I mean, after probably 2 weeks of these protests spreading to the south, to certain towns in the in the north, and even on the coast, and then finally it came to the capital when some of the labor unions, some of the civil society, some of the political parties, and political opposition started to step in and kind of these demonstrations that persisted for days and for a couple of weeks at that time gave hope to many of these opposition leaders, who some of them were, whether in exile or in Tunisia, some of them were quiet, some of them spent long years in prison, and when they left, they were really tired and kind of lost hope in that this system is going to change. But when they saw these demonstrations spreading all over Tunisia, then they started to come out and express their that they're fed up with this system. And then you started seeing these demonstrations take root in the capital. And that was basically the beginning of the end of Bin Ali. And finally, the trade union, which is the largest in the Arab world, it's a very large, the UGTT, it's a labor union, as I said, that has widespread and a huge base, declared that they will have a general strike in the capital and across the nation, and a huge demonstration in the capital. And that was it. I mean, that was what brought the dictator to flee the country, because he felt that this is now coming to his doorsteps. And there's a lot of debate about the details of what exactly happened on the last day, but for sure, large demonstrations in the capital of Tunisia made the calculation that we are grateful for, that he actually decided to leave and not fight and kill more people. So,
but I think
we're glad that he left.
Didn't he try several times to talk to the people and compromise, because later on this was almost copied by in Egypt and in Libya and in other countries where the Arab Spring later spread. Did he try to compromise? Did he try to talk to the people, and or he was threatening and then things escalated and he ran away?
Right. He's like every dictator, right? At the beginning, he was very defiant. He was characterizing these demonstrations in Sidi Bouzid and in a couple of other towns in the first week as these thugs who are trying to use the incident of Bouazizi, you know, that to inflame the country and pull us into violence, that these are terrorists that he's trying to crush. And he was very defiant in his speech. But then as these protests, you know, continued and spread across the country, he realized that he needs to change his tactic. And I think he even used some PR firms from Europe to give him some advice that he needed to kind of recognize that there is a problem. And he there's a famous speech that he delivered a few days before he fled the country, and where he said, I understand you now. They gave me the wrong information. And he tried to blame the people around him, that they misled him, that he... But now he understands, and he's willing to, and at that time he declared that he's not going to run again for another term, that he's going to make these reforms, he's going to change the government, he's going to reverse some of the measures that he took before. But the people at that time lost hope. They saw, as I said, many people died. Snipers on the roof of some of the buildings were shooting at protesters and killing them. And that just made that last speech made him look weak. And people actually said, you know, this guy does not deserve to be our president anymore, and decided to continue pressing ahead with the protests, and that was the end of it. So yeah, we did see these that his speech and his attitude kind of tried to change, and with the passing days, but at the end, the Tunisians were very resolved that he must go.
So later on, I think Tunisia had free elections and then another one. So since that day, since Ben Ali left, you've had two presidents in Tunisia?
Since Ben Ali left, we had an election where a constitutional assembly was elected. There was a government, the unity government is known as the Troika, which was the first three parties that won the election on the first, the second, and the fourth. They formed the government to run the affairs of the country, and then three years later, we had the constitution, a new constitution, very forward-looking, a very progressive constitution that many Tunisians kind of saw themselves into that constitution, and I think it passed the constitutional assembly at that time by close to 90% or more, and that shows the broad support from the various political parties, the difference in ideologies, and they all supported this constitution, and that's a great sign, and that we see that reflective into how the country was managed later on. In 2014, there was another round of elections where we saw for the first time I can't remember or think about any other country that witnessed the transition of power from one president who was elected before to at least by the parliament, to another president that was directly elected by the people in a ceremony that took place live on TV where people witnessed it and watched it. It was very moving to see that happening in an Arab world. A peaceful transition of power from one president to the next was something that was born out of the Arab Spring. Tunisia looks ahead now to another round of elections in 2019. Toward the end of this year, we'll have a parliamentary and presidential elections. Overall, I think the situation, in politically speaking, is normal. We are in a phase of building democracy, building the institutions of democracy. There are issues, there are problems in the political scene, but to be expected from a newly born democracy. But the economic situation is that what's worrying. I think the economy still struggles. Unemployment is still high. And I think that is the challenge for Tunisia, is to make sure to deliver just like they deliver a constitution and a political system that is democratic overall, but they need to deliver on the economy.
I want to thank
young folks.
We can talk about it maybe in the coming few weeks. I want to thank you, Monji Dawoodi, for being on True Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
When I come back, we're going to be talking about something interesting happening in the Congress. Marco Rubio is trying to do something that is against the Bill of Rights. We're going to see why and what. Listen to Amal from Tunisia. Welcome back to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. And next, we're going to be talking to Leah. Leah Muskin, she is the Government Affairs Associate with the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Something very interesting is taking place in the Congress, you know, that we are facing government closure. There are hundreds of thousands of American employees who are not getting their paycheck today. And then Marco Rubio starts doing something quite interesting. Good morning, Leah.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on, Samar.
My pleasure, Leah. Can you tell me and tell our listeners what is going on in the Congress with Marco Rubio? And I know that the ACLU just came out even with an opinion saying what he's doing is not is against the First Amendment. So can you tell us, Leah, what's going on?
Absolutely. So we're actually witnessing a really incredible moment. We knew the tides would turn with this new Congress, but it's turning even faster than we expected, because right when we got back to the new Congress, the Senate, their very first bill, considering a bill, S-1, that among other things supports Israel aid and opposes and tries to oppress the movement for freedom, justice, and equality in the U.S. by boycotting for Palestinian rights. So this bill includes the Combating BDS Act, which all of last Congress, AIPAC, tried and failed to pass a bill that would support the many laws across the country that repress the rights of people to boycott and actually deny them government contracts. So that looks like a teacher in Nebraska who lost their contract because they said, I support the right to boycott. I'm in the Mennonite church and I boycott. And it looks like a speech pathologist in Texas who's Palestinian American who was also denied a contract. So we have all these people boycotting for justice, and the Republicans saying, no, we don't support your right to boycott. We don't support rights for Palestinians. And what's actually happened is it's turned against them. We have all the Democrats with just a couple exceptions, voting no on this bill because they want to get back to business, but also because they realize that we have a constitutional right to boycott. There's the ACLU lining up to do the right thing, just as you mentioned, and what it looks like is that the tide's turning towards a kind of progressive for Palestine politics.
We're going to talk a little bit more about BDS and what does it mean, because some people think when you say I am BDSing Israel, it's like I am declaring anti-Semitic, but we're going to talk about it later. But just for those listening and are concerned about the closure of the government and the shutdown, why on earth would anybody think of using such an international issue? I mean, it's something not about the American workers who go there to another country and work. This is what we're facing here in America is something extremely American and has to do with us. So what's going on?
I think what we're seeing is that the right wing, like their priorities just don't match with the average American, right? Because we think that this is what's important is defending, you know, Israel in oppressing Palestinians, defending a kind of war hawkish world order. The bill also includes aid to Israel and other kinds of pro-war, kind of pro-security politics. So I think what we just see is that the Republicans think this is a priority. They want to use this political moment where everything's up in the air to sneak through really bad legislation. And, you know, people are saying no. So it's really just a question of the average person who is starting more and more to support Palestinian rights and see that Palestinian rights are human rights, being not in the same place as the Republican Party and its priorities to continue a right-wing agenda that means repressing protests wherever they happen and supporting authoritarian governments around the world.
So how many times did they vote on it? Twice already?
They voted twice and they might vote again and so, again and again.
My gosh, so they're going to keep doing it till what?
Like probably till the government reopens again, which means that there needs to be a breakthrough and some very tough negotiations between, again, these vastly different worldviews of Trump thinking that he's protecting America by demonizing immigrants, and the pro-justice parts of our politics saying no, like protecting Americans means funding their jobs and funding their communities.
Are there any countries included in this bill? Like, we're going to be boycotting or getting upset at people who boycott Cuba or
no, so this bill is, the only boycott-related provisions are about Israel, which is, you know, again, where you see the right wing kind of trying to exceptionalize Israel and say Israel gets protection from calls for freedom, justice, and equality. And that's why we're a consistent movement that says, you know, every country can go under scrutiny for denying people their basic rights.
So how is it part of the Bill of Rights? How is it part of the First Amendment? Because if I am mistaken, correct me, Leah, I remember Schumer a few years ago asked New Yorkers to boycott some state because I think something has to do with LGBT rights. I mean, we do ask people to boycott sometimes other American institutions, but how is this one violates the Bill of Rights?
So this is a great question. I just want to say, I think, Summer, you made a powerful argument right there, which is that, you know, boycotts were used. You were referencing the boycott of North Carolina to support the rights of transgender people. And, you know, in our own country, we...
Leah? Okay. Leah? Not sure why we... Leah, yeah, are you there?
Yeah.
Sorry. We lost you here for a second.
Oh,
so can you, you repeat the answer after...
Absolutely. Apologies. So just to say that you're totally right that, you know, boycotts to end separate and unequal policies have happened in North Carolina about transgender people's rights, in the U.S. South about the rights of Black Americans, and now, of course, we're boycotting against separate and unequal policies in Israel against Palestinians. But what you're... So the reason this is unconstitutional is that in 1982, the Supreme Court ruled that in an NAACP case against a Claiborne hardware store, that any boycott that's for political, social, and economic change is part of the First Amendment. So that's, you know, speech, assembly, association, petition. So the Supreme Court has ruled that when you flex your economic muscle for justice, that that's just like speaking out for justice. Okay. So it's very clear the ACLU has our back, And it's really the people trying to repress BDS who are on the wrong side of history here and are going to lose this argument.
Let me repeat it again. So according to U.S. law, I have the right to boycott whoever I want to boycott if I feel that this or that person are hurting civil rights and such causes.
That's absolutely right, Samar.
So why do they keep bringing it? Do they feel that in the midst of this shutdown, people are emotional? And, if there is a negotiation between the president and the Democratic Party and they decided, okay, we're going to pass some laws to ease the burden on people, that they might pass it, but it's illegal.
Yeah, so this has been going on for years. And this political moment, I think the right wing is losing the argument, they're trying to shut down the argument.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not just for Palestine. I just want to say briefly that a group called Defending Rights and Dissent has documented 60 laws around the country at the state level, kind of like anti-BDS laws, that say, for instance, that people can run into protesters with their cars if they're, say, blocking a highway for Black Lives Matter, and that they won't get in trouble. So different kinds of very horrible ways to try to hurt protesters and shut down protests is happening around the country, and it's because we have this really stark divide between a right wing in our country that doesn't share this vision of freedom, justice, and equality, and a rising progressive movement that has that vision. So this bill specifically is just one of the AIPAC bills that they couldn't pass last Congress, and they tried one more time to pass another bill, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, in December, and that failed. So they're just trying again. They're trying to use this moment, just like you said, to try one more time to repress our rights. And just to say, I actually think it's an opportunity because suddenly everyone's talking about Palestinian rights, right? And that's how we need to take this struggle between people standing on the side of justice and people who aren't, is to say, whenever you threaten our rights, we're actually going to grow stronger and we're going to share our message with more people. And in that way, I think that, the tides really are turning.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and I'm talking to Leah Muskin, who is Government Affairs Associate at a wonderful organization called U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and we're talking about a law that was going to pass in the Congress in order to criminalize criticizing Israel or BDSing Israel. So I got an email here, Leah, that says the Zionists don't like BDS. BDS because it works. So can you tell our listeners who might not know what does BDS stand for? What is it, and is it anti-Semitic? Is it about hating Jewish people?
So boycott, divestment, and sanctions is something that the Palestinian people, over 100 groups, called in the early 2000s for these boycotts. And it's specifically for freedom, it's for justice, it's for equality. So it's for these basic demands that would mean different groups of the Palestinian people get things like equal rights as Israeli citizens, get things like the end of the occupation. So it's absolutely a movement for justice and a movement that opposes all forms of racism. So it's based on the belief that when all people, we won't be free till all people are free, that a threat to anyone, anywhere, is a threat to justice for everyone. So, absolutely it's a movement that means that people who are Black or brown, who are Muslim, who are Jewish, all deserve their rights, and it's part of a movement in this country against the right wing that's threatening all of those groups of people.
Yeah, but I think because if they pass it, let's say it passes, doesn't that give other groups a chance to silence dissent in America?
Absolutely, and it's absolutely part of the right wing rising dissent. And I'll say specifically that, one thing BDS has shown and the repression that BDS has shown is that the right wing and people who oppose freedom are very afraid of different oppressed groups working together. So we may have seen Angela Davis being denied an award for her work on Palestine, and just prior, Mark Lamont Hill, an incredible commentator, losing his position at CNN for saying that Palestinians deserve equal rights. And this is because particularly when different oppressed communities in the U.S. work together, and in the BDS movement, that looks like Muslim groups working with Jewish groups, working with Black groups, working with immigration justice groups, working all these groups working together as a united front for freedom, justice, and equality. That's very threatening to people who don't believe in that vision of the world. So they try to repress BDS, and they try to malign it and mischaracterize it. And I think that's how you can tell BDS is working, is that it's uniting tons of different people to stand up for their rights.
Can you tell our listeners, Leah, where they can find more about it and about your organization?
Absolutely. Folks should go to uscpr.org and they can learn how they can join the boycott movement for Palestinian rights.
I want to thank you, Leah, very much for being on True Talk. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Have a good day. Bye.
Thank you. That was Leah Muskin with the organization U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Very interesting what's going on. So dynamic. Whenever I say I'm tired from doing this show, we end up with so much more material. Very soon we're going to be fundraising and you don't have to wait. I think from maybe starting next week or the following week, you can always go to True Talk. Actually go to WMNF.org and click on True Talk and you can start donating. Maybe in a couple of weeks we will be fundraising in February to support this station and our right to speak our minds. I'm going to be opening the phone lines 813-239-9663. I know that there are people already on the phone, but bear with me. 813-239-9663, and people can send messages to dj@wmnf.org. And I really want to play, Terry, if you can just wait on the line for a second, I want to play Pompeo's speech in Cairo. Oh my God. Listen, and then I'm going to open the phone line and just listen to him. He delivered it yesterday at my university, the American University in Cairo. What a shame.
It was here in this city, that another American stood before you. He told you that radical Islamist terrorism does not stem from an ideology. He told you that 9/11 led my country to abandon its ideals, particularly in the Middle East. He told you that the United States and the Muslim world needed, quote, a new beginning, end of quote. The results of these misjudgments have been dire. America's reluctance, our reluctance to wield our influence, kept us silent as the people of Iran rose up against the mullahs in Tehran in the Green Revolution. The Ayatollahs and their henchmen murdered, jailed, and intimidated freedom-loving Iranians. And they wrongly blamed America for this unrest when it was their own tyranny that had fueled it. Emboldened, the regime spread its cancerous influence to Yemen, to Iraq, to Syria, and still further into Lebanon. The age of self-inflicted American shame is over, and so are the policies that produce so much needless suffering. The United States, under President Trump, has reasserted its traditional role as a force for good in this region. We've learned from our mistakes. Nations are rallying to our side to confront the regime like never before. Egypt, Oman, Kuwait, and Jordan have all been instrumental in thwarting Iran's efforts to evade sanctions. Saudi Arabia, too, has worked with us to counter Iranian expansion and regional influence. We, the United States, commend each of these efforts. We're also seeing remarkable change. New bonds are taking root that were unimaginable until very recently. Who could have believed a few years ago that an Israeli prime minister would visit Muscat, or that new ties would emerge between Saudi Arabia and Iraq? I also applaud President Sisi's efforts to promote religious freedom, which stands as an example for all leaders and all peoples of the Middle East. America will not retreat until the terror fight is over. We will labor tirelessly alongside you to defeat ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other jihadists that threaten our security and yours. President Trump has made the decision to bring our troops home from Syria. We always do, and now is the time. But this isn't a change of mission. We remain committed to the complete dismantling of ISIS, the ISIS threat, and the ongoing fight against radical Islamism in all of its forms. But as President Trump has said, we're looking to our partners to do more, and in this effort, we will do so going forward, together. America has been criticized for doing too much in the Middle East, and we've been criticized for doing too little. But one thing we've never been is an empire builder or an oppressor. I want to thank you all for being here today.
Thank you for joining us. This is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and you just listened to an abbreviation, about 3 minutes of a 22-minute speech that was given by the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday at the American University in Cairo, a totally different venue than the one given by former President Obama when he spoke at the Egypt Cairo University to a larger crowd of people. Actually, in the speech, Pompeo criticizes Obama without mentioning his name, that he went to the people rather to the nation states, which I find it interesting to say the least. But I remember when Obama did his speech, people were like up in arms. How could he criticize former presidents, meaning George Bush? And then, like, why doesn't he say Islamic, radical Islamism? And in this full speech, Mike Pompeo repeated it many times. And it's interesting because he talks about empowering the military commanders against ISIS. And 2 weeks ago, he pushed Mattis outside. So, and he's boasting about fighting ISIS, which, you know, that the head military guy responsible for fighting ISIS also resigned. And also, this fighting of ISIS started really more than 4 years ago. Very interesting speech. I can play that part again. But again, I'm going to take your phone calls. 813-239-9663. 813-239-9663. And if you have any emails or comments to make, send them to DJ@WMNF.org, WMNF.org. And the phone number here is 813-239-9663. Let me go to the original speech in Cairo because it's fascinating how it starts. Just listen to the beginning and I'm going to take your phone calls. Listen to this.
Well, in addition to the duties that you perform here, I've had the good fortune to be a frequent visitor here to Egypt and the Middle East as Secretary of State. In my prior role as CIA Director, I was here with some frequency, and I came here, too, as a member of Congress. Every time I come, I get to see something new, something wonderful. This trip is especially meaningful for me as an evangelical Christian coming so soon after the Coptic Church's Christmas celebrations. This is an important time. We're all children of Abraham, Christians, Muslims, Jews. In my office, I keep a Bible open on my desk to remind me of God and his word and the truth. And it's the truth, lowercase t, that I'm here to talk about today. It is a truth that isn't often spoken in this part of the world, but because I'm a military man by training, I'll be very blunt and direct today. America is a force for good in the Middle East. We need to acknowledge that truth, because if we don't, we make bad choices, now and in the future. And our choices, the choices we make today, have consequences for nations and for millions and millions of people. For our safety, for our economic prosperity, for our personal freedoms, and those of our children.
We're going to go back. To the phone lines. Let me go to Sarah in St. Pete. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. That Mike Pompeo speech is just so freaking ridiculous. Full of lies, just like his boss.
It's amazing how he starts it, but there is no, I mean, I know there is no freedom of speech in the Arab world, but because of the leaders, not because the people don't speak the truth. And whenever they speak the truth, they're shot at and imprisoned.
Exactly, and President Obama went to the people where they could hear it, and Mike Pompeo saying go to the leaders is just, I swear I'm not going to swear, but it's just ridiculous.
No, please. We're going to be penalized.
And then he quotes the Bible in a country who doesn't believe in the Bible.
No, they believe that it's a holy book and there are Christians who live there and the Coptic church. But for him to say evangelical, that's a little bit maybe, you know.
It's no different than a missionary going into an unwanted territory and showing up dead.
especially when he is boasting about Trump's fighting ISIS, and really it happened during the reign of Obama. Not that I support Obama or any of his foreign policies, but he was boasting about that.
Exactly, but not mentioning the fact where ISIS started from. So he doesn't even remember the history of the Middle East and ISIS, and Mike Pompeo is just as evil as his boss and as evil as Bolton.
Oh, okay.
I know you didn't bring him in, but it's just totally ridiculous.
No, I don't think I can handle Bolton on the show. Thank you so much, Sarah. I really appreciate it. Again, the number is 813-239-9663. 813-239-9663. I think we have time for another couple of calls. Let me go to Andrew in Hardy County. Good morning, Andrew.
Hi, Samar. Yeah, I love your show. What you're doing, you may get tired, but please continue, because what you're doing is one of the most important things that WMNF puts on the air.
Thank you so much.
Valuable things.
Thank you,
but,
Andrew.
You know, listening to the recording and thinking especially about a man talking about his religion underscores the fact, and I actually want to talk about freedom of speech, but that underscores the fact that the manipulation of religious belief and ideology is something that the United States has deliberately, coldly, and brutally used to undermine secular states everywhere. And now that they're getting things the way they want them, their main objective is to undermine the secular state in the United States. And that's been going on for a long time. And it's nothing but just simply another line of attack for elitism. It's another line of attack for we've got the money, we've got the power, we've got our worldview, and we're going to enforce it on everybody else. Just like we're going to enforce our particular religious views on women's bodies. And it's the same thing.
Actually, sorry, Andrew, but because we're running out of time, not sure if you listened to all his speech, because he was kind of trying to berate Obama and rebuke him because, the radicals in this country were very upset that Obama doesn't use the term radical Islam, as if it makes me radicalize or disappear or something. And in his speech, he kept saying Islamism, radical Islamism, in all its forms, and I'm thinking, what does he mean by that? Because who can define what is radical and not radical?
Yeah, and again, it's simply using the tool of manipulated religious ideology against the entire population. You know, whether it's anti-Islamic bigotry in the United States by hypocritical Christians, or whether it's being done in the Middle East. The same phenomenon, exactly the same phenomenon. And the undercutting of our freedom of speech in the United States as relates to the earlier part of the program is directly related to their desire essentially to control the mental and intellectual atmosphere in this country, to keep the population down and quiet, just as they're doing in the Middle East. We're all being... One thing we can say about the right wing is that they are equal opportunity oppressors. They don't care where you live, which part of the world you're in. They know that they're supposed to govern everything, including your thought process. And you are a beacon of light, and True Talk is a beacon of light for true freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and please keep carrying on.
Thank you so much, Andrew. I really appreciate the kind words. Yes, we're very blessed here at WMNF to have a show where I, who is originally Palestinian but was born in Kuwait, because my parents were made stateless when the state of Israel was created on historical Palestine in 1948. But I'm an American citizen for the past, gosh, on next December, this coming December, it will be 30 years for me here, and this is home to me. So we're very lucky to have WMNF. We're very lucky to have the Bill of Rights. So I hope our listeners will Google the word BDS. BDS. Google Palestine before 1948, where my husband was born, my parents were born, my grandparents were born, my uncles and my aunts and my cousins were born. It was under the British mandate, under the British occupation. So Google these things so you know what is some people, what are some people trying and foreign nations trying to do through the Congress. BDS, Google it, learn more, and keep up the good work of supporting WMNF. This is 88.5 FM, and I think NPR News should come any minute now.